Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
The FT Money Show is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace provides everything you need to create an exceptional website for your business or hobby for around £5 per month. Start your free trial today and enter the code MONEY to save 10%. Whatever your idea is, build it beautiful on Squarespace.
The champagne's on ice as the London Stock Exchange celebrates 20 years of AIM, the alternative investment market. But why are investors the least likely to be raising a toast? Plus, we ask what more could be done to help private investors who are tempted by AIM's tax breaks to better understand the risks in the market and assess the £1 billion spending spree that UK pensioners, flush with newly freed pensions cash, could now be embarking on. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Kate Burgess and Josephine Cumbo, plus our special studio guest, Professor Paul Marsh of the London Business School, our resident AIM expert. AIM, London's junior market, was officially launched 2 decades ago this week as an alternative to the main market for small and fast-growing companies. Over the years, companies listed on AIM have raised a staggering £92 billion, and the index has provided an irresistible lure for private investors who dream of investing in the early stages of a company like online fashion retailer ASOS. However, research to be published in FT Money this weekend shows how steeply the odds are stacked against you when it comes to picking a winner. I'm joined in the FT studio today by Professor Paul Marsh of the London Business School, part of the team that designed the FTSE 100 index, who, alongside his colleague Professor Elroy Dimson, is a shrewd observer of the small cap universe. Paul, thanks for joining us today. Your data shows that as an index, AIM has been a shockingly bad investment overall. Over the past 20 years, it's produced a negative annualised total return for investors. Now, you've previously said that the biggest puzzle is why AIM's underperformance persists and why investors don't learn. Have you come any closer to explaining this conundrum?
There are lots of reasons why AIM has underperformed. I'll just pick three of them. The first is it's an IPO market. Most of the companies listing on AIM have listed via an IPO or by going public. That means it's a young market, and so it's predominantly made up of companies that are young and unseasoned. And there's lots of evidence from around the world that IPOs tend to underperform after they've gone public. And this is something that AIM has suffered from. The second reason, it's been a fad market. It's part of being an IPO market, and so all the latest fashions, the dot-com boom, right the way through to the more recent resource boom. And investors generally don't get rich when they're investing in the next big thing. And then finally, AIM's a growth market. It's full of growth stocks, and there's again lots of international evidence from other markets that growth stocks underperform, probably because investors get too excited about growth and overpay for it. But the puzzle, as you say, is why investors don't get wise to this and mark down the prices of AIM stocks to the point where they do offer a decent return. Perhaps some of the underperformance we've seen is actually that process of repricing the market. But I'm not convinced about this because AIM stocks as a group don't look cheap to me.
Well, that's a very interesting point that you raised there about whether they're cheap or not. But the other popular myth about AIM is that if you look at the index as a whole, it performs badly. But if you pick those, amazing stocks that outperform, then you're in the money. I mean, what would you say to this assertion that AIM is a stock picker's market?
Well, I think the myth is that stock picking is easy. What people mean by AIM being a stock picker's market is that there's a big dispersion of returns. There's a lot of companies that have been poor performers, and there's a handful of really big winners. And people sometimes say, obviously no one would hold the AIM market as a whole, implying that all you've got to do is pick the good ones and leave the others alone. But actually, in aggregate, investors as a group do own the AIM market. That's what they own. And they've had very poor returns from it. And picking the big winners is tricky. It's a very competitive market. Everyone's trying to find the next ASOS. And the people who are best equipped to do this with extensive resources and experience are the professional fund managers. For many private investors who try to do it themselves, they're at a big disadvantage. So I think AIM can be quite dangerous territory for them.
Now, a short teaser for our listeners. In this weekend's FT Money, available online and also within your copy of the FT Weekend, Paul and Elroy have helpfully identified the top 10 and bottom 10 performing shares in the history of the AIM index over the past 20 years. I don't think I'll be spoiling anyone's birthday surprise by saying that ASOS came top of the charts. Had you invested £1,000 when it first listed on AIM in 2001, you would now be sitting on a rather stylish £162,000. So look out for the full feature this weekend. Sticking with the AIM theme, I'd now like to bring in Kate Burgess, the FT's Small Talk columnist and Small Companies correspondent. Kate, you're writing the Serious Money column this weekend, in which you argue AIM stocks should be graded to help private investors better understand the risks. Can you explain your thesis?
Well, it's a thought rather than anything else. It was conceived as a loosely regulated market where you balance the cost of listing for companies against investor protection. The thing was, when it was conceived, I think 95% of AIM companies, and bear in mind there were about 10 when it started and, you know, 200 or 300 within 3 years.
Yeah.
It's now 1,000 companies. But when it started, 95% of the shares were in the hands of the entrepreneurs, founders or venture capitalists.
People who were well suited to those kinds of risks.
Exactly. And now we're talking about, after successive tax breaks, a very substantial amount of shares that are now in the hands of outside investors.
And more recently, the ISA tax breaks, brokers are telling us, have encouraged a fresh wave of private investors to look at AIM afresh.
Absolutely. According to the LSE, about £4 billion worth of shares were transferred into ISAs 2 years ago when the break was first introduced. That's a very different investor profile. And I think that the regulators need to look at that, and an AIM needs to grow up. You know, it's 20 years old. It's time it moved from being a teenager into, you know,
a young adult.
Yes, exactly.
What are the kind of things that you think AIM should signpost to the perhaps more unwary investor?
It's going to be difficult because what no regulator wants to do is to give advice. But it seems to me that increased disclosure or signposting might help. They could badge stocks that have free floats below a certain level where they become too illiquid for outside investors to have any kind of sway. They could badge the international companies from places where the governance standards aren't the same as you would expect from a UK company. They could badge the companies that comply absolutely with the UK corporate governance codes. It's just a way of signposting where the risks are. It's not telling investors that they shouldn't take risks, but just making them aware where the risks are.
Well, I look forward to reading in full your argument for greater disclosure in FT Money this weekend. Now, I'd like to ask both of you if you think that the better regulation on the AIM market would improve performance, or if there is any sign, Paul, that the regulatory tightening we've seen in recent years has had any positive impact.
I don't think the tweaks that have been made so far have had very much impact. I'm not sure the problem is the rules as such. It's probably more the way the rules are implemented. And at the heart of the AIM regulation is the nominated advisor regime.
The NOMAD.
The NOMADs, absolutely. Every AIM-listed company has to have its NOMAD, and the NOMAD brings the company to market in the first place and then acts as its minder and advisor and regulator and guider. And the problem with this is there are about 40 different NOMADs listed under the London Stock Exchange rules. And some of those NOMADs are excellent, but others are really rather poor. And the poor ones tend to bring companies to market that probably should never have come to market in the first place. Mm. And there's another problem. If the nomad finally decides that the company that they're looking after is no longer worthy of their services, they just resign. Then the company's got 1 month to find another nomad, but it's got the stigma of having its existing nomad having just resigned. So that's difficult. After a month, the company gets delisted. And that seems to me to be a rather poor way of protecting investors, because it just leaves the investors high and dry.
Well, as well as liking to think that they can spot the next ASOS, lots of private investors are also attracted to the tax benefits of AIM, as we've been saying, particularly business property relief, which means stakes in certain companies can be passed on free of inheritance tax. This, coupled with the tax advantage from holding AIM shares in an ISA, do we think this is distorting the market?
Let me make a distinction between the ISA and the inheritance tax breaks. The allowing AIM stocks to be held in an ISA, I don't think is distortionary, because you can hold any stock in an ISA, so there's actually a level playing field. It was distortionary in a sense that you couldn't hold AIM stocks in ISAs before. So I don't mind the ISA. The inheritance tax break is a bit different.
Okay.
And the inheritance tax break, and any break like that, the problem with that is that for some investors, it causes them to be prepared to pay more for the stock because it's worth more to them because of the tax breaks, and that is distortionary. And so that is rather distortionary, but also the other distortionary effect is that investors and the entrepreneurs tend to be rather locked into the share because of the inheritance tax break, so that also removes some liquidity. So I think both of these are distortionary. And there is also a danger that investors who invest in AIM but don't benefit from the inheritance tax breaks, or don't intend to, or don't, or can't, actually end up paying too much for the companies in the first place. So that's another potential distortion.
Which leads me to ask, by encouraging private investors with these tax breaks, are we in danger of throwing those less savvy investors onto the fire, Kate?
I think there is a danger that it will attract investors who don't read annual reports from cover to cover and don't manage to get to talk to companies and know what's really going on, that they're lured in by the ASOSes of this world. You know, even ASOS will have lost people money if they bought in at the wrong time.
This is true. It's had a rather rocky few years.
And that's the nature of AIM. It's a, you know, it's a technicolour market.
Paul, you said earlier on that you thought that the fund managers, the professional fund managers, were the best placed people to do the stock picking. Certainly we've heard from two star fund managers in FT Money this weekend about what their techniques are when it comes to assessing AIM companies. Is this probably a better route in, do you think, for private investors tempted by AIM?
I think it is a better route in, but the performance of AIM has been so poor that even the professional fund managers have struggled as a group. So we should not overestimate the riches of AIM from these stock pickers. They are actually fighting against very big odds. For example, you would have lost money over the last 20 years from investing in AIM. £100 would have become £83, even with dividends reinvested. But if you put it into non-AIM, smaller UK companies, you would have quintupled your money. You would have made five times as much. So that's a huge gap that you have to make up from stock picking. And even the very best professional fund managers find that a stretch.
Well, happy birthday, AIM. Sorry to be a party pooper, but as Paul and Kate have shown us, there's lots to consider for investors thinking of having a punt. Thanks very much, Paul and Kate. For the full rundown of AIM's top 10 winners and losers, log into ft.com/money this weekend or pick up a copy of the Weekend FT. This week, pensions freedoms once again hit the headlines as Chancellor George Osborne triumphantly revealed that over £1 billion of pension pots have been cashed in since April's rule changes. Ka-ching for the Treasury, which tellingly did not provide an update of how much extra tax revenue might be collected as a result. I'm joined by Josephine Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent. So, Josephine, you've reported this week that 60,000 pension savers over the age of 55 have now cashed out £1 billion from their pension funds £1 since April's rule change. Was this the level of withdrawal that industry and government were expecting?
Well, before the pension freedoms came into force in April, there was a lot of speculation as to how people might respond. We knew that up to about 320,000 people a year could cash in, and there was a lot of pent-up demand from 2014 when the government first announced the policy. So all in all, it could have been more extreme than it was. As it is, 60,000 took advantage of the new freedoms from April, so not as big as it could have been.
And we should say that doing the maths, it works out to about £20,000.
That's an average, yes.
So in some people's estimates, not as high as it could have been. But do you think that there's pent-up demand from savers whose providers are making it trickier for them to access their cash?
Yes, I think in recent weeks, reports have certainly emerged of savers being frustrated trying to cash in their pensions due to a variety of reasons, ranging from their providers not offering the most easiest or cost-effective ways to get their cash out, to the provider insisting they get professional advice, which can cost hundreds if not thousands of pounds before they'll process their request. It's important to note here that some of the frustrations that people have been experiencing are due to the expectation, part fueled by the government, that they could take their money out like a bank account from day one. Mm. And this type of flexibility hasn't emerged among all providers. And just to give you a sense of frustration that has been building this week, I heard of one case where a customer threatened a pension provider's call centre staff to have a confrontation in the car park
if
they didn't release his cash immediately. So the situation is quite heated. But it's important to note that the advice safeguard is not one that providers are insisting. It is a legal requirement in certain circumstances. If your pot is £30,000 or more and has a safeguarded benefit such as a guaranteed annuity rate or it's a final salary pension, a transfer value of £30,000 or more, it's a government requirement that you get professional advice on that transfer just to make sure that you fully understand what you're doing. But there is more concern and confusion about how this advice safeguard should be applied by providers. Certainly evidence that they might be going a little bit further than they should do in insisting on customers with smaller pots who are outside that safeguard on getting advice, and that is creating lots of frustration and headlines for newspapers.
That's true, but in my view, too much advice is hardly a bad thing. Now, it's in the early stages, but what could the medium-term effects of this policy be? I mean, for one, what are savers going to do with that £1 billion worth of newly freed pensions
cash? Well, in the short term, there certainly has been a dash for cash, and it will provide a boost for the economy because the reports are that the money is going into holidays, home improvements, B&Q perhaps, and all the other providers will get a boost from all that cash in the short term, and people paying down debt. Mortgages as well and other personal
loans.
Which would be quite a sensible idea to use a small pot to pay it down. But there could also be effect on the property market to some extent as people are using cash to help their children get onto the property ladder. They're helping them out.
Mm.
For the Treasury, it's good news, as you mentioned earlier on, because they get a boost in tax take. And that works because when someone cashes in their pension, what happens is after the first 25% typical, which is tax-free, they'll pay tax on whatever they take down, and they're taking it in a lump sum. They might be pushed into a higher tax bracket. So all that tax is coming in earlier for the government than it would have done if that individual had taken an annuity and was paying tax on smaller doses right throughout 20 or 30 years. So the interesting question now is whether George, the Chancellor, is just happy with how much cash is coming in. If the system is being blocked and people aren't being able to access their cash quite in the way that the government had envisaged, you know, perhaps we might see some action to ease the logjam.
Well, hopefully it won't come down to fisticuffs in the Downing Street car park. Well, thank you very much. That was Josephine Cumbo, pensions correspondent for the FT. We'd love to hear about your experiences of investing on AIM. Hopefully you've managed to beat the index's lacklustre average returns with your portfolio or pensions freedoms. or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch via email. The address is money@ft.com, or you can tweet us @ftmoney. And you can leave your comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else is in this weekend's edition. In a dream assignment, Money reporter Judith Evans examines frothy beer valuations in the world of crowdfunding. We've share tips from our sister publication, The Investor's Chronicle, and the latest director's deals. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Kate, Josephine, and our special studio guest, Professor Paul Marsh.
Thanks to Squarespace for support of this podcast. Some of the top creative professionals in the world use Squarespace's simple yet powerful platform to build their brands online. Start your free trial today and enter the code MONEY to save 10%. Whatever your idea is, build it beautiful on Squarespace.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.